Good afternoon. It's about 3:07. I would like to bring the House Hess Committee to order. And present are Representative Vasquez, Tarr, Stutes, Del Rico, Wool, myself, Chair Seaton. Remind everybody about their cell phones. Today we're going to be hearing from the Office of Children's Services following that with a second hearing on HB 27. We wanted to get public testimony from online, and anyone who wishes to testify at this time on House Bill 27, we're not intending to move that today. First we will hear from Director Lawton, but I wanted to let everybody know that we'll be adjourning early. There's a number of closeouts today and meetings, so we are planning on adjourning at 4:15. And is there anything that anybody has? Seeing nothing, then Director Lawton, are you on board? You online?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I'm here.
Oh, great. We can hear you fine. And would you identify yourself for the record? And then what we would like you to do is address in a little more detail some of the Citizen Review Panel recommendation and the Office of Children's Services response and any other ideas you have for going forward for making the system work better.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Christy Lawton. I'm the director for the Office of Children's Services. Thank you for having me back today to spend just a little bit more time reviewing and responding to the recommendations from the Citizens Review Panel. I believe you all had a copy of their report along with our response to that report. And their report really focused on four areas that they spoke to and made some specific recommendations. The first being a number of different changes related to our policy around intake practices. And intake is the function by which we receive reports from the community with alleged maltreatment and make decisions about how the agency should respond. They made a number of good suggestions in terms of ways that we could improve. And we've elected to adopt all of those recommendations. And we do have a longer-term plan as a part of our federal five-year plan, in fact, to move from our five regional intake units to a streamlined and more efficient and hopefully more effective centralized intake functionality, which will help us adopt and make those changes as a part of an overhaul of policies and training that will happen as a part of that. The second recommendation that they focused on is also an area that we have spent a lot of time talking with them on and is an area needing quite a bit of attention and development. So that recommendation really focused on how we need to develop a model for serving families when the children are in their own home, what we call in-home cases, whereby we do have some families, if we have the right services available and the right safety network around them, we can prevent a child from being removed out of home. But it does take a much higher level of oversight and monitoring and support services. And we have really struggled as an organization to figure out how to do this, particularly in rural areas where the caseworker and the ICWA worker may be the extent of the services available and how to make safety plans that are sufficient and also with people that have a range of skills to work with a parent on any number of identified deficits or challenging issues they have. This is also an item that is reflected in our five-year plan that we have worked with the feds to develop, and we're being monitored and held accountable by them for the completion of that plan. And we plan to seek assistance from some national resource centers in terms of trying to come up with a model that will fit for Alaska. We don't believe there is any one particular model currently in existence that really meets Alaska's unique needs, but that we're going to really have to take perhaps components from a variety of models to really construct something that's going to to suit the needs and be able to meet the changes we have here from a geographical as well as workload perspective. So again, this is a recommendation we wholeheartedly agree with and we'll be spending quite a bit of time working on over the next several years as a part of our five-year plan.
And before we go on, if you're finished with recommendation two, I think that it would be good to just have the committee, since they're hearing this dialogue, to go ahead and ask questions at this point if they have questions on developing that model. I'm not seeing any yet, but I did have a question. When we're talking about, you know, the teams that you set out and the information you were able to generate out in the more rural areas, one of the things is reading the cases revealed extensive involvement of village safety officers, school officials, tribal partners, and community leaders. This support will be integral to, will be an integral piece of building an in-home program that can be effective to serve rural areas. Is there any engagement with tribal entities in something like the Circle Justice or any of those contacts and interactions, or are we specifically focusing on someone that's providing a state, basically a state enforcement service or something like that?
Mr. Chairman, we have worked closely with our tribal partners around the state on this issue, and in fact, a year ago, we ended a five-year project that was a collaboration between 13 different tribal organizations as well as the National Indian Child Welfare Association through a federal grant that really was around how we could work together to support the development of increased tribal infrastructure, and they were actually working on developing their own unique models of practice for serving families in their own home. That was a successful project in that many of the tribal organizations successfully did develop their own models, which then gives more ability for us to communicate clearly so we understand what each other's doing, how we're operating, and when we refer families to them, we know what to expect in terms of the types of services they're going to get. That being said, the challenge still remains. I mean, most of where those organizations were, you know, they're stemming out of hub locations. And when you think of, for example, a community or a region like the Western region, where Bethel is the hub, and the Association for Village Council Presidents has an agreement with, I think it's 52 individual tribes and communities surrounding that area. In most of those areas, they have a singular, or some of them don't even have one, but a tribal worker. And we have offices in just three of those communities in that large region. So when we look at serving a family in their own home, we are looking at what the tribe can bring to the table in terms of traditional types of services that are not necessarily Western types of services, as well as, you know, looking to our state partners and public health, public safety of what they can offer too. But the reality is often even combined, we're not always hitting the mark in terms of feeling like we can leave a child in their own in their own home, you know, without the kind of oversight we require sometimes.
Okay, thank you. Representative Stutz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems like there must be some difficulties or some kind of lack of connect in some capacity in the intake process. So if I were to walk into your office or into a office and say I'm concerned about a particular young child, what would be the process so that I know whether I'm related or not related to that child, that that child is going to have some immediate attention insofar as services or assessments insofar as that child's safety? Is there anything that you, I'm sorry for making that such a long, difficult question. Is there any way that you can immediately accommodate somebody that walks into the office with a concern?
Through the Chair, Representative Stutz, yes, anytime there's a walk-in to the office, they would be getting our attention, and we would be connecting them with an intake worker, whether that be via phone or whether that be in person. Our policy is that regardless of what somebody is reporting, we are to assume that it has to do with child maltreatment, even if it's not clear in what they're reporting, and we document it in our electronic data management system as such.
So you would take my name as the reporter and document it that I came in and said that there's an issue. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, yes, that is exactly what should happen.
Thank you.
In most of these communities, we're talking about at least a place where there's probably 10 children, so there's a school there. Are the schools involved at all, or is that kind of an excluded section to work with, or excluding? Are we excluding those personnel from working with the case for any reason?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely, the school is an integral a part of our communication and partnership, and particularly in those communities where they are kind of the center of the community. Often that's where the caseworker is going to conduct the interviews, talk with the staff and teachers. It's likely in many of those cases the school was the reporter. And so we certainly are connecting with them to try to figure out what they can also help and support. They're often in a difficult role being in the communities as such, and we try to be sensitive to that, but they're very much a part of our process.
Thank you. And as you can tell from the questions that we're asking, we're really not intimately familiar with the entire process that we're dealing with here. So don't feel at all that hold back on explanations for us, because we are wanting to understand the situations, but we just don't have that much experience. So are there any other questions on the recommendation to response? Seeing none, thank you, Chris. Would you go on?
Certainly. Recommendation three was for us, for the Office of Children's Services, to look at addressing what we consider to be, or what they consider to be, the root of the initial assessment backlog problem. And I'll describe this for you a little bit so you understand what we're talking about here. So initial assessments is also known as investigations. So after the point of intake, we've decided to screen in a report to go out to conduct an assessment of safety or an investigation. The worker does those initial contacts, collects information, makes a decision, at some point within typically the first 30 days as to whether or not they think the child's safe or not safe, and is already thinking about, whether this is going to be a case closed with a referral perhaps, or a case that needs to remain open for longer. Once the decision that's made in concert with their supervisor is made that it is a case that's going to be closed because we didn't find any safety threats or reasons to believe the child is in impending danger, the worker, because of many of the issues we've spoke of before around workload and the rising workload, is often setting aside the paperwork that goes along with officially closing that case record while they're out initiating new investigations in terms of establishing safety. And so what often happens in child welfare is that the paperwork comes second to the people and to, the pressing fires and the issues that we need to be out in the field for. And this backlog over at least the 17 years I've been in the agency has been higher and lower and kind of fluctuates, and you can often see the patterns related to the workload and the staffing patterns that correlate. So the backlog problem is really speaking to investigations that have not been closed within the policy that's required, which is 45 days, and that's when a parent would get notification as to the finding. We are continuing to address that and stay on top of that. We've got a number of firewalls in place and managers that are monitoring this closely, because it is important for these cases to be closed for lots of reasons. But unfortunately, it's a challenge that is difficult to solve entirely when the resources are constantly stretched, just as they currently are. And I'll stop to see if that made sense or if there's questions, perhaps.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Did I understand you to say that when you get a case, it has to be closed within 45 days?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, when we are responding to a new report of alleged maltreatment, the worker goes out and initiates, and then they have up to 45 days for that case to be closed. Typically, most of the contacts and interviews are done within the first week to 2 weeks, and then there's also a variety of collateral contacts that the worker would be doing to, you know, put all the information together and typically come to a decision whether that case should remain open or it is appropriate to close within 30 days, and then the supervisor has up to 45 days to make the final decision and sign off.
Follow-up, Representative Stutes.
Does that include the disposition of the child, whether it be remaining in the home or being taken out of the home?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, they would be making an assessment about that. It's not a disposition in the legal sense in most of our cases, since they don't go through the courts, but certainly our evaluation and assessment of the family looks at whether the child is safe to remain in their own home with services, safe to remain in their own home with no services, or whether an out-of-home removal is required.
Reverend Stutes.
Well, thank you. So that's the determination that needs to be made within the 45 days?
Through the chair, Representative Stutes, yes. And in many cases where removal is necessary, that decision is made within, you know, the first few days that we have a case open, because it's a striking situation we've encountered.
Thank you.
Further questions, Rep. Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'm just wondering two things. One, with the assessments increasing, the initial assessments increasing, are we seeing any more complexity? I guess I'm not sure if that's the right word, but you know, are the situations more difficult to assess in any way? And then with just looking at the overall numbers, and you know, I've been focusing a lot on child sexual abuse. I know the number of allegations is up. I think that's true of all forms of child abuse. Is there just more reporting going on? I think when I read before, there was a suggestion that maybe when we're raising awareness more, that that might also result in more reporting.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, we have seen some gradual increases over time in terms of the total number of reports we're receiving. The rate of those reports coming in is not as striking, however, as the rate to which we're assigning new reports for investigation. And the distinction here is that they're not at the same rate, I guess I should say that. We have been making practice changes over the last several years to try to really get ahead of the issues around repeat maltreatment and what causes repeat maltreatment by trying to get to some of these families far sooner than what we have done before, so that they're not coming through that revolving door a half a dozen or a dozen times before we actually take an intervention with them. Mm-hmm. So some of those are based on practice changes that we're having more families come into the system for an assessment of safety. And then, although we have not studied the issue in terms of severity per se and complexity of the allegations, anecdotally I can tell you, based on what I hear from my staff and the reports that I see, they are far more complex and more severe, I think, in recent years. We've seen a lot more challenging situations with domestic violence. Substance abusing has not gotten any better, at least from the child welfare perspective, and those combinations continue to be deadly for kids.
And just thank you, Mr. Chairman. So it sounds like you're saying, whereas there might have been, you know, 10 cases in 1 year, just using just generic numbers here, 10 cases, and you know, 3 or 4 of them were referred for investigation. You know, we've seen a little increase, and it would be 12 cases, but now more like 8 or 9 of them are referred for investigation. Would that be a way to think about it?
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, yes, that would be an accurate way to look at it.
Thank you.
Representative Wool.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Along the same lines of question, Looking at your graph here, and I remember from your last presentation, you said the number of calls coming into your centers was increasing over the last several years, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, yes, we are seeing a slow increase in those calls, yes.
And follow up, please.
Yeah, follow up, Representative Wool.
The assessment, so there's basically three phases. There's a contact, and then an assessment, and then you decide if there's an intervention. Are all of these going up proportionately in the last few years?
Through the chair, Representative Wool, you would see the number of reports that we are assessing in relation to the numbers of kids that are being served on an ongoing basis, whether in the home or out of the home. You would definitely see that proportionally spiking up. It's not as proportional to the number of calls being received for the reasons I stated a few minutes ago, in that while we have some growth in the total number of reports that we're receiving on any given year, we have made practice changes that result in more of those reports being screened in for an investigation sooner than what they might have been previously.
Okay, thank you.
Further, Representative Wolf.
Well, my last question is an obvious one, but addressing the backlog, I'm assuming you have the same number of people addressing these increasing number of responses, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Wolf, yes. We haven't seen an increase in the caseworkers to respond to those.
Thank you. Just forget that.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Christy.
Certainly. So the fourth and final recommendation was that OCS work to improve relationships and improve in the ongoing development of relationships with communities and make that a priority. This I think was specifically focused in on many of our rural communities, but really I guess rural or urban, that these partnerships are essential to our ability to serve families, and certainly we can't do this work alone. So that is certainly a recommendation that I concur with and promote often. It is a challenge, however, in many cases with some of the turnover that we see, unfortunately, the relationships don't get to where we need them to be. And then the other challenge we have is that for many of our smaller communities where this becomes more prominent, workers literally are dropped off in the morning and picked up a couple hours later. They're in and out to do their job, and it really doesn't lend the kind of time to be in the community to get to visit and talk with people in a way that isn't just kind of in a crisis response mode. That's something that the workload continually sort of prevents us from being more proactive in getting out there. On the other hand, it is working very well in many communities because the people have been there for a long time and they have wonderful relationships. But when it's not there and it's not working, it's pretty striking and it can be problematic. So it continues to be an area that we're working with our staff and managers on to find more ways that they can really promote those kinds of relationships.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On this priority, I'm just wondering, in my conversation with a couple other folks from the Citizen Review Panel, we were talking about prevention efforts, and their assertion was that that falls outside of the scope of your mission. But I'm just wondering if this recommendation, it sort of suggests that more work should be done on prevention and include these community partners. And I guess I'm just wondering if you can respond to that. In your overall workload, how prevention efforts kind of fit into that.
Through the chair, Representative Tarr, I certainly think it's within our purview and responsibility to have relationships with key community partners and stakeholders, service providers. And to that end, we'll keep trying. From the prevention perspective, that is a harder, it is a mandate of the Office of Children's Services. We do have prevention programs. It is a part of federal requirements. But in terms of our average caseworkers and supervisors that are out in the field, that's not where their time is focused as much as we would like it to be. So no, that is less an area of getting attention than the other.
Thank you.
Follow-up? Further questions? Director, I was wondering, does it, you know, with the higher percentage of folks from Alaska Natives in foster care, does that relate to the in-home model or the inability to have the enough contacts within rural communities? And so is that part of the driver for more rural Alaskans or Alaska Natives to be in out-of-home care?
Mr. Chairman, if I'm understanding your question correctly, I think there is a relationship. If we had more sufficient and effective models and ways to deliver services around in-home, you know, more children would be able to remain safely in their own home, Alaska Native and otherwise, which would be a good thing for those families and communities. When those things are not available, and it's most, you know, prominently seen in some of the most rural and economically challenged communities, we know that when children are removed from their homes, and sometimes, you know, whether they're placed in three villages up the river from them, or they're placed in the hub from their region, or worst case scenario, they end up in an urban location, they're not going to fare as well as if they had been able to remain in their own home for lots of different reasons. So I would say that they're definitely intertwined very closely.
Okay, thank you, and that's, you know, we do appreciate you working on that recommendation. Do you have anything else to add for us, or does any of the committee have any further questions? I don't see any from here. Director, do you want to fill us in on anything else or any other initiatives that the department is having to work on these problems?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. The Office of Children's Services has got an array of new initiatives and work efforts currently underway, many of which are spelled out quite clearly in our five-year Child and Family Services Plan, which can be found via our website. And that really is a plan that has been tailored to address some of the most challenging areas that we have and some of the deficit areas we see in terms of the outcomes families are experiencing. I think some of the exciting work that will be coming from that is our centralized intake plan that hopefully will be happening in about a year from now. We also are looking at some new innovations and establishing a birth parent mentoring program, which other states have been quite successful in, which they have found to really help with engaging parents and helping them to be more successful in the system when they have another parent mentor that can help, you know, walk them through and give them that coaching and understanding of a very complex system. You know, somebody from a more neutral perspective than a caseworker or even maybe their own attorney. So we're excited about that. We're also hoping to come up with some strategies to take what has been happening largely in urban areas in terms of a model called team decision making, or TDM. It's a mechanism really for just bringing together all of the key case participants and people that support the family around issues that are critical, primarily placement decisions. We have struggled to expand that statewide because of the various striking differences we have amongst regions and where people are located, but we have found that to be a very successful model in terms of increasing the transparency of agency decision-making and really having more inclusion of not only the parents, you know, the typical child welfare legal parties, but also the people that support the parents, the foster parents, relatives. And so we are looking to find a model that will work for every area and try to have some models, particularly in some of our rural locations, that are more culturally normed, you know, perhaps with talking circles or those kinds of family directed types of meetings. I think I'll maybe stop there. Unless there's further questions, I could give you a longer list, but I don't want to take too much time.
No, that's good. I'm glad to see the kinds of initiatives you're working on, and appreciate you being online again today, and thanks for addressing these. We really like to see that the Citizens Review Panel recommendations have been addressed well, and appreciate that seems to be making progress, which is always good. So thank you again for testifying today.
Thank you.
Now we'll go to HB 27, and we have the sponsor here. And we had just a short introduction of this bill before. So would you like to introduce the bill again, Representative Guerra?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Les Guerra, District 20. I'm here with my aide, Molly Carver. I appreciate you hearing the bill again. We're working off the sponsor substitute, and I believe you've received the most recent fiscal note, which is thankfully a zero fiscal note. The bill has a number of goals, and you'll see from the letters of support that we've tried to make this sort of an evidence-based bill. We've also tried to do what we have to do this session, which is try to make it a cost-effective bill. So if I were to tell you all of the things that are wrong with the foster care system, a number of them would have to do with large amounts of money. And that's not something that we're getting a great reception to this year. So you're going to live with overworked and social workers and social workers that have caseloads that in Anchorage and Mat-Su are 50% higher than they should be. We can't address that in this bill. Here are the things that we can address, though, and these are all evidence-based. We know from studies that foster youth who are taken away from their homes and often bounced between a number of homes suffer emotional damage, and your committee, I think, is more familiar than any other committee with the ACEs study, the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. Foster youth tend to have very high adverse childhood experiences scores, and they get worse as youth bounce from one home to another home to another home. And you've probably heard from youth by now who've been in 5, 10, 15, or 20 homes. One of the best things you can do for a youth who's been badly damaged and is not ready to go out on their own is to allow them to stay in foster care until age 21. Alaska's adopted a law allowing that, and one of the things this bill does is requires that during the status hearings before the judges that they have to go before is for OCS to show what they should know in the first place. If they're going to release a child before age 21, they have to show it's in the best interests of the child. That's always the standard for children. Is it in the best interest of the child? And if the social worker has done their job right, as they try very hard to do, they'll be able to demonstrate that. So a lot of this bill has to do with the court asking the question, did you follow the standard that is the evidence-based practice for foster youth? There's a study by the Casey Foundation, and the Casey Foundation is very interesting. It was founded by the gentleman who founded UPS, and he had a very strong interest in foster care. And so he started a wonderful organization that's national at this point. But the Casey Foundation says if you release a child before 21, release them at 18, they're quote-unquote less likely to complete high school, more likely to have physical, developmental, and mental health challenges. Most lose their existing support system when they reach 18 are discharged into state custody. Here's how that manifests itself in Alaska. If you release somebody before they're ready, they end up living on the street. 20% of Alaska foster youth end up homeless in this state. It used to be 40%, and you might think that we've made progress. It used to be 40% because we used to count people who couch surfed as homeless. We don't anymore. If you add those people, it's 40%. 20% end up couch surfing, 20% end up on the street homeless, 24% end up in jail, incarcerated. To give a child stability is important. To reduce the number of placements and disruptions in a child's life is important. In 12 states nationally, just among kids who have biological parents, in 12 states, the average child is staying actually in their home past childhood to age 25. Those are children who have parents. We're talking about children who bounce between homes. So that's a very key part of this bill, is to just demonstrate to a judge that before you send a kid out of foster care before age 21, you show that it's in their best interest, that they're ready, that they can stand on their own, that we won't have to pay for them with social services, frankly. It's a cost saver and sort of a, it's just a measure of our own humanity, I think, as a society. Here's another thing that's very key in the area of foster care. It's sort of a code word, it's called permanency. You've heard it. And all it means is that foster children need what our children get, a stable home. That's what permanency means. There's a national standard that youth end up in a permanent home, our foster youth, within 12 months for some groups of foster youth and 24 months for others, depending on whether you're being reunited with your family or adopted out. And OCS does very well with some youth. They achieve reunification very quickly with some youth. But with some youth, it's 5 years, 10 years, or longer before they ever end up in a permanent home. So our bill simply says that at the status hearing, we have this national standard. It's 12 or 24 months that we try to get youth into a permanent home. We're not doing that for a lot of youth. There are reasons sometimes that have nothing to do with OCS, have something to do with the amount of damage the child has suffered, whether it's through sexual abuse or other abuse. But the court is now going to ask, if this bill passes, have you taken all reasonable efforts to make sure you can find, you found a permanent home for a child? And the all reasonable efforts standard, we worked with OCS, that's the standard they use in a lot of other sections of the statutes. We had originally all feasible efforts, but it's all reasonable efforts. Make all reasonable efforts. That's important. Because if you have a young social worker, and unfortunately at OCS, there are a lot of young social workers who last on average, the new ones, sometimes only 18 months or so before they leave, before they burn out. Maybe they just have not had the experience on the job to be able to get a child into a permanent home. So it's good to have a check in the system. Everything in this bill really is a check in the system. Has OCS done what they should do to try and find a child a permanent home? A permanent home like the children that every one of you have. Because if you keep bouncing a child between homes, all we're doing is creating institutional child abuse and neglect. It's not intentional, but it's what happens. It's what we do to children when we bounce them between homes. So that's the second major part of the bill. There's a nursing journal called the Permanente Journal, if you would just let me read a couple sentences from it, that talks about why permanency is important, Mr. Chair. Is that okay?
What's that? I'm sorry. I was...
Oh, there's a nursing journal called the Permanente Journal, and they have a brief statement on why permanency is important, if you wouldn't mind me just reading a couple sentences.
Brief, yeah. Otherwise, we have people to testify, so we don't want to run them out of time, and we can have you back up.
I'll just skip over it. And I can get it for folks, but basically, the more foster homes you send a child through, the higher their ACEs scores get, the more damage you do to them, and the more likely you are to pay for them in the criminal system or through social services. The third part of this bill that's very important is, and this is from the Center for Foster Care and Education, but it's also a nationally recognized standard. Everything in this bill is that if you yank a child out of school in the middle of a school term, they fall upwards to 3 months behind in school. So you have a child who's bounced from one home to another home to another home, and in the middle of the school term, you bounce them from one school to a different school to a different school with a different curriculum. Guess what their academic achievement is going to be? It's going to be worse than if we let them finish their school term in their original school. So nationally, for homeless children, we have a standard that says for homeless children, you have to let them stay in their school term, their same school of origin for the remainder of the term. Don't yank them out. I mean, you have to if they move from Queeth Luck to Anchorage, then you can't do anything about it. What this bill says is if it's reasonable and in the child's best interests, you let them finish in their original school for the rest of the school term. It's a national standard. It's been studied. It's evidence-based. The other thing we do in the bill, Mr. Chair, and this is not a high burden on OCS, because we can't really place high burdens on an understaffed foster care system, but OCS has a duty after they take a child from their parents. It's a national duty, and frankly, OCS has a stricter standard. In the first 30 days after they take the child from their parents, kids are normally placed in an emergency placement home. There are a lot of people who sign up to be emergency placement foster parents. Those tend to be larger homes. Those tend to be not the best homes for youth. They often have a 30-day limit. Families often aren't willing to hold them there, and sometimes youth will bounce from one 30-day home to another 30-day home. Sometimes the best placement for a child is a member of the extended family. And in certain cultures in the state, members of the extended family are just as close as important as the immediate parents. So the current law is after you yank somebody from a home, take somebody out of their home, you should start a 30-day search for families and friends of family members who might be able to take care of the child and be the best placement. We extend that. So many youth end up in foster care for 5 to 10 years and bounce between homes. We also add that there should be a constant lookout if you're going to keep bouncing kids between homes for family members, not just those first 30 days, but as long as the child is in foster care. We've run into so many youth, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, who when they're 18, 19, 20, find out that there is a family member willing to take care of them. Maybe it was not OCS's fault that they didn't find that person. It may not have been. But we just want to put that standard there that before the emergency placement and after the emergency placement, we just keep looking for family members as OCS is able. I don't think I can emphasize, with the shortage of foster parents that we have in the state, and we have a massive shortage, and in part, people just leave the foster care system because they don't get their phone calls returned, because the social workers are overstaffed, and they leave. We lose some of our best foster parents. In that kind of situation, if you have a loving relative, I don't think you can beat that. And if you have a loving relative who's willing to take care of the child, you're going to save a lot in the way of treatment, jail costs, educational costs. You're going to save money, and it's going to be more humane. So that's another major portion of the bill. There's a portion of the bill that is really a message to the governor and a message to OCS. We've put money in the budget over the last few years into the capital budget to advertise to try to get more foster and adoptive parents. And small amounts of money, $50,000, $75,000. I've used my own discretionary money at times to do it. They've been good ads, but we're still short. We're very short of foster parents. There are 849 youth waiting for adoptive homes in the state right now. And I don't have time to show you, but that's way out of proportion of many other states. Well, how are we going to recruit more adoptive and foster parents for free? I've done it. Amanda Mativier, who would be on the line today, has done it with me. She had to go to the hospital today. She'll be okay, but she would have testified. She runs Facing Foster Care in Alaska, and many of you know her. But we would like the governor to do it when he's in front of a crowd of 1,000 people. We'd like staff at OCS to do it and seek out places at lunchtime where they can pitch that we need foster parents and adoptive parents. That doesn't cost any money. I'll keep doing it, but we would like, frankly, everybody to do it, and I think the governor would be willing to do that. So we just put that in the statute. There's a provision that's important to the Alaskan Native community, and that is that sometimes in an ICWA case, OCS will investigate whether or not to take a child away from a home. And they'll say, you know what, this doesn't meet the standard for taking a child away from a home. But we found some severe problems the child is facing, some severe treatment needs, some severe academic needs. But right now, OCS is not able to share that information with the local tribal organization. So there's a part of this bill that allows OCS to negotiate a confidentiality agreement with a tribal entity so they can share that information. There are two other small provisions of the bill. One is the law currently says everybody else is entitled to a vibrant education, an adequate education. In the foster care statute, for some reason right now, foster youth are only entitled to what's called a basic education. I just find that offensive, Mr. Chair. I don't think anybody intended it that way. But we changed the words to say an education that involves a traditional school or vocational education. We use very few words. We don't talk about private schools, public schools, any of that. We just say they're entitled to an education or vocational education. We take out the word basic, basically. We think that's a limiting factor. And there is a part of the OCS system that affects youth 16 to 23. It's the independent living program. We only have 6 workers in that who are responsible for helping transition older youth into the community. 6 workers for about 300, 400 youth. They actually, frankly, don't know most of the youth that they're supposed to be helping with that number. It used to be 4. We added 2 a few years ago. Now it's 6. And basically, we just want a simple report from OCS on an annual basis. They'll know the answer on whether or not the funds we have for employment and training vouchers, those are vouchers we use to get to youth so they can get vocational education or go to college or get their GED or do the things that are going to keep them off the street and make them successful, are the funds that we provide in those ETV vouchers adequate for the need? The answer will be yes, or the answer will be no. But we should know that, and OCS already knows that. It's just something we should see as a legislature. That's pretty much the bill, Mr. Speaker, members of the committee. We did everything within the constraints of trying to fund or put together a no or a low-cost bill, and thankfully it's a no-cost bill as we could. There's a lot more I would do if we had the funds, but that's what I can do right now with the guidance from the legislature, which is they're really only looking at low and no-cost bills right now.
Thank you. Are there questions for the sponsor?
Yes.
Representative Stoops.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. This could be real simply answered. I noticed through here it says on page 4, line 23, another suitable person. Is that... does that have a definition somewhere in another statute? What is suitable? And then along those same lines, as you mentioned earlier, reasonable. The word reasonable is used quite frequently in this. And is there a definition somewhere of reasonable that would apply here?
Thank you. It's on page 4, line 23, another suitable person. That's not actually any change that we made in the bill. That's actually the existing law right now. The change that we made in the bill is on page 5, line 11. But another suitable person, I think OCS would interpret always as they interpret it, is it a person that's in the child's best interests? In terms of making reasonable efforts, it's a standard that OCS has worked with for a long time in the statutory system. Reasonable efforts, the kind of efforts that a reasonable person would engage in. That's how it would be defined. But OCS asked us to use the terms make reasonable efforts because that's the statutory standard they already operate within right now. And so we wanted to keep the language consistent with the law that they use right now.
Reverend Stoops.
Thank you. I would presume that I would have to ask that question to OCS. Is there some place somewhere that I could look up to find what their definition of reasonable is?
And Representative Stutes, we do have Naomi Hammy from the Office of Children's Services here today. So,
great.
So, yes.
Molly, who studied the bill better than I have at times, says that the term reasonable efforts is defined in the statute. But we will... Not in this section. It's in the definition section. We'll get that to you.
Bye.
Thank you. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Guerra. And our students, foster kids that are over 18 but under 21, if they requested to be released from the system, could they be?
The legislature has adopted that as the rule, and so that's in the statutes. I think I gave the chair a couple of those statutes, but right now it's 318. OCS tries to look out for the best interests of the child as best as they can, but once a youth turns 19, and if they say, even though you're telling me continuing in foster care is good for me, I want to leave, they can leave. And that's always considered by OCS, but they have to listen, but it becomes mandatory at 19.
If
the child wants to leave.
So you're between 19 and 21, and they requested to leave, OCS would take that into consideration, but they would take the totality of it into consideration, and if they deemed the child in his best interest to stay, then that would be the decision.
Through the chair, Representative Wall, this is a confusing part of the existing law. We're not changing any of the existing law. If you're 19 and you request to leave, you can leave. Okay. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. I suppose there might be some odd case where somebody has a mental challenge that maybe they have a conservator. But outside of a case like that, if 19 and you say, I want to go, you get to go. And before that, it's certainly something OCS will consider. And it's happened many, many times.
Okay. Representative Vasquez, and then back to Representative Bull. Is this a follow-up on the question or a different
question? No, it's a different question.
Okay, Representative Vasquez.
Yeah, hi. Has OCS, have they had an opportunity to comment on this proposed bill?
Through the chair, Representative Vasquez, we have worked with OCS on this. I can't tell you what their position is on it. We try to work closely with them to make the bills workable. We try to work closely with them to make the bill workable for them, and changed the language where we're able to meet their needs. But I can't speak for OCS.
And Representative, we do have someone from OCS that can testify. Are there further questions? I just had a couple. One was on page 7, line 27, where it says appropriate in requiring disclosure of appropriate information. Is that confidential information that is required to be held under other sections, and does that include all information, or what is appropriate information in?
Thank you. To the chair. If you look at line 30, it will all be subject to a confidentiality agreement, so it will be confidential information. The types of information, there are some federal laws you can't violate, like HIPAA, for example, right? We want to give OCS and the tribal entity the flexibility to come up with a confidentiality agreement to allow the tribal entity to know the information they could use in order to help the child that lives in their community.
Thank you. And then on page 8, where we're changing from a child to or person who has been committed to custody, and then if the person is 19 years of age or older and consents, since we changed from child to person, does that mean that someone can be 26 or 27 years old and not consent? Is there a limitation in some other part of the statute that says that it ends at 21?
Through the chair, we have only extended foster care to age 21 in the state. I don't actually know of another state that's extended it past 21. There's been a national movement for states to extend allowing youth to stay in foster care to age 21, and we've joined that. The word or person just means that you're under the statutes, you're a child until 18. And under the statutes, once you're 18 and one day old, you're a person. So that's why you have to say the word person. I can't say that's how I would have written the statute, but throughout the statutory, throughout the whole section of through the whole title, you're a child until 18, and then between 18 and 21, you're not a child, so they define you as a person. But it's only up to age 21.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Representative Roy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up a little bit on Representative Vasquez's question in regards to OCS's input on two points, one being you addressed the caseload and how they're increasing and they're all backlogged. The requirement that they search for family members beyond 30 days, and I don't know with what frequency, each time they're transferred to an emergency home or every 30 days, do you or does OCS feel that that requirement would be an added burden that they may not be able to fulfill?
Through the chair, Representative Wall, we've made it a much more relaxed standard for these additional time periods, the ones that aren't the one that exists right now. The one that exists right now is federal. It requires a comprehensive family search. It's a very strict standard during those first 30 days when somebody is taken out of their home. We don't use those terms afterwards or before. We just say, look, you should always be on the lookout for a family, but we don't make it the same comprehensive level search as it is during those first 30 days, because they probably don't have the resources to do that. But they should always be asking. And a couple phone calls as a child's being bound, you know, you're already making phone calls when you're looking for a new foster home. A couple phone calls to say, is there a family member we should be looking for, I think is justified. But we don't add the comprehensive search standard that applies during those first 30 days when a child is taken out of their home.
Okay. Thank you. And I do want to go so that we have room for public testimony that's online. And before we do that, though, I wanted to just make sure that we had a motion. Well, in fact, I'll make it to adopt the fiscal note that we have for HB 27 to the sponsor statement for the bill. I mean, the sponsor substitute for the bill. So that fiscal note. Is there any objection to adopting the fiscal note to the sponsor substitute? We had a change, and we can always ask for modifications or something, but I just want to get it associated with the bill that we have in front of us. Okay. Representative Vasquez.
I mean, the only objection is, before hearing what OCS has to say, OCS may well come in and say the fiscal note is not realistic in light of what is required. I mean, I think conceptually I totally agree with what the bill is trying to do. It's just, it seems that it's a fiscal note of zero may not be possible.
And Representative Vasquez, this is from the department. So we'll query the department. They're up next. So thank you, Representative Guerra. And couldn't read the writing. We have Naomi Harris in the room. Is that correct for OCS? Let me get Trevor Storrs first. He's online. Make sure that we have the testimony online. Trevor Storrs, are you online?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you. Would you identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony?
Absolutely. My name is Trevor Storrs. Spelled T-R-E-V-O-R, last name is S-T-O-R-R-S, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Children's Trust. Thank you to you all for this opportunity to testify today on HB 27, and specifically thank you to Representative Guerra for all of his work that he does for not just our foster children, but all of our children here in Alaska. Many of us think our number one resource in this state is oil, but truly our number one resource are our kids. They are what defines us of not who we are today, but who we will be tomorrow. And it will be very important of how we treat them today to determine what tomorrow will be like. What HB 27 does is not only reduces trauma in these children's lives who already have experienced vast amount of trauma, but also ensures resiliency, but most of all, levels the playing field. Most of our children do not experience the level of trauma that these children do. Most of them have, I'll use the word normal in quotes, life. But unfortunately, several children in our state do not, and that's where OCS steps in. OCS does what they can, but unfortunately, many of these children do have to be removed from their families. The trauma that these children experienced prior to that removal was horrific and will have lifelong impact if not addressed. But once they are removed from the family, that removal only adds to that trauma. And you would talk to many of these kids that they would rather stay with their family and endure that trauma versus the experience of the trauma that they endure to be removed. But we know as a society, it is important that we do remove them from unsafe environments. But it's also our responsibility to ensure that it is done in such a way that it reduces the trauma and provides these children with the resiliency and the strength they need to overcome the trauma that they experience. Many of you have heard of the Adverse Childhood Experiences study that shows the relationship of the impact that toxic stress, like child abuse and neglect, has on the development of a child's brain that then leads to a high increase of risk of experiencing many of the physical, social, and behavioral ills that we are dealing with as communities, whether we're talking diabetes, obesity, being a victim of child abuse or a perpetrator, not graduating from high school, being part of our correctional facilities, substance abuse, and suicide. Many of these things do not just cost us, our youth, but cost us financially as a state. What you have before you is an opportunity to change policy that will strengthen these children. The sooner that a child has permanent residency, the sooner that they can deal with their trauma and deal with the issue of not being potentially with their mom and dad. The closer that they are placed with a family member that is close to their parents versus somebody who's outside of the family, let alone outside of potentially their hometown and potentially even outside of their culture, makes it that much more difficult. HB 27 encourages and recommends and makes it a statute that OCS, the state of Alaska, individuals taking responsibility for these children, truly work hard to make sure that these children are as close to family as possible. The number one thing of resiliency, which is that ability to bounce back from adversity like child abuse and neglect, is the connection to a loved one, an adult who cares and loves you. And the more that they are connected to not just the community, but the family, the more resiliency that they are able to give that child. And most definitely will have a greater buy into the success of that child. I encourage you all to support HB 27. Even if OCS does come back and says there is a fiscal note to this. This is priority because either we pay today or we will be paying tomorrow. We know that many of those who are in our correctional facilities, in our treatment for substance abuse, individuals without a high school diploma, many that are battling other issues are kids that experienced life in the foster care system. It is our responsibility, it does take a village to raise a child, to pass HB 27 to ensure that these kids have the resiliency to overcome that trauma and can become true, productive members of our community. I appreciate you all for listening to me and for considering HB 27. And again, thank you to Representative Guerra for all of his hard work.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions? Seeing none, let's go to Naomi Harris.
And just so the committee knows, we do have a member, the Office of Public Advocacy, online from Anchorage if we have questions for that one. Would you identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and go ahead if you have testimony to offer?
My name is Naomi Harris. I'm the Community Relations Manager and Legislative Contact for the Office of Children's Services. And I don't have testimony, but I am available for questions. It sounded like there were some before that I can, if I wrote down, I can respond to them if you'd like, or?
If you have them written down, why don't you go ahead and just go through them, and then we'll get to the additional ones.
Right, it was through the chair, Representative Vasquez. You asked if if OCS had an opportunity to comment or what our stand was on this bill, and I can report that the administration is neutral on this bill. We have worked with the sponsor as he indicated, but right now we are neutral.
Okay, thank you.
Then, through the chair, Representative Wohl, you had asked about our efforts to place or to search for relatives and relative placements past that 30 days, and we have it in policy that we do continue to search for relatives throughout the life of the case, recognizing the importance of relatives in a child's life and hoping to find placements. Sometimes, as the case goes on, new relatives will be identified, and we want to continue to keep the children in the family, so we do our best efforts.
So, following up on that, do you see that there would be any difference in the action of the department if this was in statute or if it's in your policy now?
I don't see that it would change our practices.
Okay. Thank you. Were there further questions you had noted?
I believe that's all at this point.
Okay, and I believe Representative Vasquez had a question on the fiscal note.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. In reviewing this bill, is there any projected additional costs on the part of OCS to implement what's in this bill?
That fiscal note is in response to this version of the bill.
Okay.
And right now it's a zero.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to your comment that the department is neutral, is that take it or leave it neutral, or you, if it passed, you would be fine and your life wouldn't change at all neutral? I don't know what that means, neutral.
The administration is neutral on this bill. Many, as you know, as outlined in the fiscal note, that many of the activities are federally mandated or already observed in policy or in practice.
Representative Wohl, follow up.
So what you're saying is if this bill passes, it wouldn't change the day-to-day or the procedures that are that the department is currently practicing.
1 second. Running it through my head. I think this wouldn't change many of the practices in that the agency already observes in response to federal mandates or state statutes or our own internal practices at this point, but I think that it does provide some alignment or some clarification at some points.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Vasquez.
Okay, so you now have children in custody up to age 18 years, right?
And to 21, they can remain in care until they're age 21.
But this would make it more mandatory? You would have additional children under your custody under this bill?
No, this would not increase.
Oh, okay.
The caseload.
Only if the kid consents. It would have to be by consent.
Are there other questions for OCS?
So there would be no additional costs? I mean, I would imagine there'd be additional children consenting to be in custody.
Existing practice. So I'm sorry, through the chair, Representative Vasquez. That's existing statute that children who are in foster care can remain in care or return to care until they're age 21. That's existing. And what is outlined in the bill is when we can release with the child's consent or if it's in their best interest.
Representative Stutes.
I noticed that it's, through the chair, thank you. It says that based on a fund availability that they would provide education and vocational training. There's a lot of ands in there, and I guess I'm having a hard time. Do you provide that now? I'm having a hard time getting my arms around the fact that there's no fiscal note with this.
we've reviewed this bill pretty thoroughly, and that fiscal note is accurate with this bill. I mean, currently we provide education and vocational training, and the language in this bill allow for assistance in obtaining that educational and vocational training. It's previously, as the sponsor stated, it did say basic education, so it's expanding on that language.
So the question is, you're not from a department view seeing any difference in practice between basic education and educational opportunities that you're currently providing?
Representative Seaton, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Quick follow-up. So I would be so presumptuous to assume then that if there's no fiscal note and the department is neutral on this, it's really not going to make a difference if you have this bill or not, insofar as the department's or our relationship with any of the individuals at this time. Is that correct?
Representative Stutes, through the chair, I think that I would refer to my previous answer that many of the pieces of this piece of legislation are exist in federal mandate or state statute or our policy as a best practice. So I think that there is potentially an overall alignment.
And Representative Stutes, a quick follow-up, and then we're going to have to adjourn.
Okay, so there really wouldn't be any significant changes at all?
Representative Stutes, through the chair, not at this point.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. The sponsor coming forward and the department, people testifying, and we will hold this bill for future. And thank you, and we will adjourn at 4:20.